Good morning. You're listening to KYRS. You're also listening to Praxis. Before we kick off the hour, I should let you know Praxis receives support from Puff and Glass Studios, a purveyor of functional glass art and smoking accessories, 8 locations in the state of Washington. Information available at 509-328-0661 and online at puffandglassstudios.com. And as I said, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. I'm your host, Taylor, and today will be a jam-packed hour with a lot of information, a healthy level of rage, and hopefully some calls from you all out in the world. I love to take calls on the live show and want to start promoting that a little bit more, as well as taking comments on Facebook. So, if you would like to chime in at some point when we get rolling here, the number to call is 509-747-3807. You can call from anywhere in the country, at least, and likely in the world, if you don't mind the charges. That'd be a lot of commitment, I guess, to chime in. But, yeah. So, and I am posting this on Facebook right now, also with that number. If you want to follow along with the conversation there, chime in. Find out about the podcast when that's posted, suggest topics, put your input in onto topics. The address there is facebook.com/praxisradio, PRAXISRADIO. So, yeah, check that out if you are so obliged, and yeah, do that. So, I think, so today, basically, if you haven't been living under a rock for the past week, you know that there's been ongoing violence, protest, general police chaos, and today, last night, the National Guard being called in Ferguson, Missouri, following the death by police of unarmed 18-year-old Michael Brown. So if you haven't been following that story, I'm impressed with your insulation, and you'll learn a lot and probably have some catching up to do on the show today. But it's been an interesting story, and as always, I'm going to talk about the story itself, but also the ways that it's been covered in the media in the U.S. Some examples of the ways that coverage can skew our understanding of something. And I'm also going to do some updates about Gaza, the ongoing siege there. What people can do about it, chiefly the participating in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. There are some encouraging wins going on in the U.S. and more. So, and what do those two have in common? Also, is a thread. I might share pieces of an article that I wrote that was published on the Inlander's blog that made some ties between these two, between Gaza and between Ferguson, and police violence against African American men in general. And a lot of the comments were said, you know, there aren't any commonalities, and the only thing in common is that you have bigotry toward white men and toward Israel, which not accurate, but there is a lot of confusion out there in the world, is all I can say about that. So, without further ado, I think we'll just jump in. I'm going to start. This is a long piece, as usual, but it's a good segue because we just heard Chris Hedges on Alternative Radio. It's also been revealed to me that Chris Hedges will be coming to Spokane to speak in March, so somebody to get familiar with, maybe, for those who aren't. I read some of his books earlier on in my life that were pretty helpful, pretty insightful regarding U.S. culture and militarism and all of those things that I end up hearing a lot about from me if you listen to the show. So this is a piece that he just posted, Chris Hedges, on TruthDig.com, where he is a regular columnist. This was posted yesterday. It's called Rebellion in Ferguson, A Rising Heat in the Suburbs. And I'm just going to share a lot of it verbatim, and I will chime in as fit. And if you hear anything that you want to push back on or add to or question, please feel free to call in at 509-747-3807. So Chris Hedges says, the public reaction to the fatal shooting of an unarmed black teenager by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, exposes the shifting dynamic of rebellion and repression in the United States. Spontaneous uprisings against the lethal force routinely employed by militarized police units will probably not erupt at first out of the old epicenters of unrest, Watts, Detroit, Harlem, Newark, and others, but suburban black communities such as Ferguson near St. Louis. In most of these communities, the power structures remain in the hands of white minorities, although the populations have shifted from white to black. Only 3 of the 53 commissioned officers in Ferguson's police department are black. These conditions, which approximate the racial divides that set off urban riots in the 1960s, have the potential to trigger a new wave of racial unrest in economically depressed black suburbs, and perhaps later in impoverished inner cities, especially amid a stagnant economy, high incarceration and unemployment, and the rewriting of laws to make police forces omnipotent. We're headed into a period of increased social protest, said Lawrence Ham, one of the nation's most important community organizers and longtime chairman of the People's Organization for Progress. POP, which has roughly 10,000 members, is based in Newark and has 13 chapters, most of them in New Jersey. I met with Ham in a downtown coffee shop in Newark. The pendulum swung far to the right after 9/11. Now it is swinging back, Ham said. Fear and paralysis gripped the country after 9/11 and the creation of our authoritarian police state. We're overcoming this fear. The rebellion in Ferguson was not planned. It was spontaneous. People said enough. They struck out in the only way they knew how. All the other ways, and I have no doubt that the people in Ferguson and St. Louis, as we have, marched peacefully, sent letters, and went to city council meetings to protest police violence, have proved ineffective. We will see other incidents like this one, but because of demographic changes, these rebellions will occur in places that did not rebel previously. So that was all from Lawrence Ham. I don't know if that was clear when I read it out loud. Ham said that the declining populations of primarily black cities, Newark, where he has spent most of his life as an organizer, has seen its population drop from 400,000 to about 250,000 in the last few decades. Coupled with the election of black officials and the integration of blacks into police forces mean that the old centers of rebellion are less polarized. He says, these changes help to ameliorate the overt racism and will probably prevent a reoccurrence of open rebellion in these urban areas, he said. In cities like Newark, you no longer have a blatant apartheid structure. This dynamic dampens, to a degree, the movement for social justice. It dampens the outrage. It dampens the ability to mount opposition to ongoing institutional racism and oppression. But we have suburbs around Newark, much like the St. Louis suburb Ferguson, that were once white and are now black, and that replicate the racial power imbalance. And this is where the tinder will be. Being the object of unwarranted deadly force by police officers is part of what it means to be black and poor in America. But as Ham said, no matter how much blacks raise their voices against indiscriminate police violence, the killings keep coming. He says, the police are the primary instrument of social control, but after the rebellions in American cities in the 1960s, the federal government under President Nixon realized that the police were not enough. Nixon began to link the local police with the state police and the National Guard. During the rebellion in Detroit in 1967, the state had to deploy the 82nd Airborne. Nixon set up the seamless connection between local police units and the military. It was then that we began to see a change in training, the acquisition of military equipment, and the arrival of SWAT teams in black uniforms. In April 1999, when we marched in Orange, New Jersey, to protest the torturing to death by the police of Earl Faison, the police deployed SWAT teams on the roofs of the post office and department stores. These teams had their automatic rifles pointed at us, and we were nonviolent marchers. The real criminals were within the ranks of the police. I think I'm just going to keep going with this because there's good info in it and it gives a lot of the background that we're going to need to keep going. If you're just joining us, this is a long piece, Rising Heat in the Suburbs by Chris Hedges, where he interviews Lawrence Ham, the community organizer out of New Jersey. In the 1970s, Ham obtained a scholarship to attend Princeton, and when he graduated, began work on a doctorate at the university. But he abandoned his doctoral work to return to Newark, where he had grown up. In 1983, the organizer co-founded POP, one of the nation's most impressive grassroots radical movements. He can routinely pull thousands of people into the streets and is one of the most rousing orators in the country. He was always an agitator, organizing a student walkout in city schools when he was in high school, but he credits his political maturation to the playwright and poet Amiri Baraka, also from Newark. They met in 1971 and remained close friends until Baraka's death last January. It was Baraka, he said, who inspired him to commit his life to political struggle on behalf of poor people. And he carried that commitment to Princeton University, where he mobilized students to carry out sustained protests against the numerous ties between the university and the apartheid regime in South Africa. Groups like POP come out of the Black Liberation Movement, Ham said. They are led by people who were deeply involved in that movement and who are committed to a lifetime of struggle. Many of the organizations that existed in the 60s don't exist anymore. POP is one of the few survivors. But POP is also consciously anti-sectarian. One of the pitfalls of the movements of the 60s was ideological sectarianism, that if you're not of a particular ideology, you're wrong. Groups spent more time attacking each other than attacking the forces of oppression. We avoided that. That's why we've lasted years. That's referred to by many, this is me talking, not Hedges, as a horizontal hostility, and it remains a real problem for people looking to mobilize for any type of social justice, fighting with each other. Though, I don't know, it's something I'm torn about because there are people who I don't, who I have strong ideological differences with. Yeah, we'll get back to that, but whew, that's a whole show in and of itself and a whole big topic to explore. Back to this Hedges piece. Ham says, there is a historical ebb and flow of social movements, and that's true of the Black Liberation Movement, he said. You don't have an ever-increasing radicalism. You have highs and lows. There was a conscious effort to destroy the Black Liberation Movement of the 1960s. The state had great success in that regard, but it did not totally end. People continued to fight, even though we had COINTELPRO and the assassination of Black leaders, as well as the incarceration of other Black leaders. And for listeners, if you are not familiar with this term, COINTELPRO, with that program, it's something to really look into if you're exploring the gritty underside of United States history. It explains a lot of, you know, people ask, oh, what happened after the 60s? There were all these promising movements. And a large part of that answer is that the FBI, through this program, COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program, through targeted assassinations and through intentional disruption and mass arrest, demolished a lot of those movements, including AIM, the American Indian Movement, the Black Panther Party, and many others. So it wasn't just that people gave up, it's that they were taken out in many cases. That's what Ham's referring to there. He says, it's easier to fight the external aggressor than it is to fight someone who looks like you, like Barack Obama, he said. We have to grapple with this until enough people become convinced that it's not about individuals and that it's about institutions and systems of oppression. I don't think most people yet see it that way. We struggle to try to help people understand that it's not about individuals. It's about white supremacy, capitalist oppression, and imperialism. But the majority does not share the racial consciousness, the radical consciousness that we try to imbue. Black consciousness is oppositional, but oppositional does not necessarily mean radical. Oppositional means that people have a clear enough perspective that allows them to see an injustice, and maybe a set of injustices, and the desire to change those injustices. A radical consciousness requires a change of an entire system. And people in general, not just Black people in general are not born with radical consciousness. We have to bring that kind of consciousness to them through education and persuasion. Black people see the election of Barack Obama as oppositional in terms of opposing white supremacy. But we want to tell people that just electing a president, even from a very conventional political point of view, is not enough. He continues, there's a difference between prophetic tradition, which we need, and political movement building, Ham said. Many of us knew when Obama was running for president that if elected, he would be the CEO for U.S. imperialism. But if the very people we purport to serve and represent are going in a particular direction, then we have to look very hard at how we operate in that given environment. Our struggle is to build a politically potent movement. We're not going to be able to build that movement only with the people who have the most radical consciousness. When Obama is wrong, we criticize. But when the choice is between Obama and something worse, we do not tell the people to go out there and choose something worse. We don't want to alienate ourselves from our own base. We have to accurately assess and be truthful about what's happening, but at the same time, we have to do that in a way that doesn't alienate us. After all, he went on, the problem confronting the left, Black, white, and otherwise, is that we're weak. We don't have enough people. We're weak because of the state of the labor movement in the United States. There needs to be a symbiosis between the struggle for racial equality and the labor movement. You see that in countries such as Jamaica, but not here. 3 decades after he co-founded POP, Ham, 60, admits to some frustration. POP is a great organization, he said. I'm proud of our accomplishments. I'm proud of our members. But I have to say, as a criticism of myself, that after 30 years, we should be stronger than we are. I'm growing increasingly skeptical of the ability of electoral politics to bring about the kind of social change that not only African Americans need, but that working and poor people in general need. He said, we made the best progress when we were in the streets in the 60s. There were more than 1,000 urban uprisings, and that is what we need to do most, put people in the streets. Whew, so that was a long but pretty rich interview with Lawrence Ham of... Sorry, wow, that just disappeared, of POP, and interviewed by Chris Hedges here on truthdig.com. You can find it there. You can also find it in the links that I will publish in the podcast later today. You can find that at facebook.com/praxisradio or at praxisradio509.podomatic.com. So again, People's Organization for Progress Chairman Lawrence Ham, interviewed by Chris Hedges. Some pieces of that that I wanted to point out that are really relevant for this conversation about Ferguson, Missouri. You'll almost exclusively hear the mainstream media referring to what he refers to as an uprising as rioting, rioting and looting, general violence, general chaos. Some of the words that you'll hear are chaos, rioting, looting. Words that you are very unlikely to hear in the mainstream media that you can find from people reporting directly from the streets to the extent they're allowed to on Twitter. Some of the other outlets that are there in Ferguson with a little less antiquated political understanding refer to it as an uprising, as a rebellion. And that's part of what I wanted to focus on today is our language when we talk about things like this, and also just the how much this incident and it's the reaction to it have revealed about the racial consciousness of the United States. It's really low. It's really inadequate, to say the least. And I guess I probably shouldn't have been shocked, but I've been kind of shocked at things that I've heard people I know say in my community, particularly and more intensely people I don't know, such as people in the predominantly white St. Louis suburbs near Ferguson are saying openly in their campaign to support the officer who shot Michael Brown and killed him. I have an interesting account of some of that here too, but just yesterday, I was having a conversation with a member of my family who I'm very close to, who in general I would say, you know, gets it, for lack of a better term. But she was basically complaining about the people being out in the streets causing more violence, and asked, you know, why don't people just? Wouldn't it be better if people had just stayed home for 3 days? And I was kind of vehemently against that because that's what happens, you know, every day, just about every day, when an unarmed black man is shot, or black person, I should say, but generally, frequently men are targeted by the police in this extrajudicial manner, are denied due process, and are killed. And there's a lot of arguments that you'll hear about that, about how hard it is to be a police officer, and you know, we need to trust them to that they probably made the right decision in shooting someone. But there's a study that you can find that shows that every 28 hours, so just about every day, an African American person, usually male, is killed either by police or security in the United States. So that's significant. And every time that that happens, we don't see an uprising like we have in Ferguson. So that strategy that my family member was suggesting of staying home is to some extent what happens a lot of the time. Or if there is mobilization, it's It's more contained. It's in a less overtly racially tense area, as Ham pointed out in that article, and as people have pointed out. Ferguson is predominantly Black. 3 of the 53 police officers there are. So the same statistics, it looks the same for the city council, the mayor's office, all of the seats of traditional political power are still predominantly white in a community that's predominantly Black. So it's not representative. And there's a lot of existing tension. So it's a lot better by my approximation. You know, these aren't my strategies to determine, but I feel like it's a lot better to be defiant in that situation, to come out unified as a community. You're not at as much risk if everyone's out, if the kids are there, if, you know, though children being there has not stopped the police force, the highly militarized police force in Ferguson and St. Louis County sheriffs from deploying clouds of tear gas, using rubber bullets, and other crowd control techniques, most familiar to me from Palestine, from the West Bank protests there, and in Gaza, but to some extent, Gaza is a different is treated differently. But protests in the West Bank definitely look a lot like Ferguson does. And while it might seem, you know, police forces might try to sell things like tear gas and rubber bullets as a more humane way to control people and dissuade them from rising up or from interacting with the police in that way, in a way other than submissively. Tear gas canisters kill people. It's not unheard of for that to happen in the West Bank and in other places where they're deployed. Same with rubber bullets, can cause serious injury. So it's not something that I think people should be okay with being fired on a crowd that includes children and anyone for that matter. But, you know, we're so steeped in a culture of violence and militarism that I think people don't see it as crazy as I do. And like many other people do, that this is not an okay thing to do. So that is kind of a rant about that, about, you know, why don't people just stay home? And it also shows, you know, maybe this person's disconnect from the reality of a community like Ferguson and the history of the U.S. and how there's never been justice for Black Americans since they're kidnapped and brought here. Like, justice has never been a concern of the government, and it's never really in a mass sense been a concern of the culture. And that's why we see institutional racism and individual racism and passive individual racism by supporting these systems, denying that there is such a thing as institutional racism, which has been very common, mostly among white people in the past weeks. So yeah, it's interesting to see what's happening. I'm really glad that there's so many people, largely on Twitter, as we've seen in pretty much every major social upheaval since about 2010, people who are actually there, people who live in Ferguson and who can offer some context, are doing great reporting on Twitter, which you can find by, you know, searching Ferguson hashtag. There's also some good collections of people's tweets and photos that you can find with relative ease. I'm not going to share photos on the radio, obviously, but it's a really good way. If you have time, it's pretty fascinating to look at the mainstream media's coverage. Look at, you know, ABC or NBC, CNN, whoever, you know, pick a three-letter acronym. Look at their coverage and then see what you might see. You might see, for instance, a report this morning that McDonald's was broken into and looted, and that it'll say, oh, you know, violence, looting, proof that these people are violent, etc. Why don't they just quit it and go home? If you read on Twitter or see some other places, the McDonald's was broken into. The only loot that was taken was water and milk to help rinse out the eyes of people who had been affected by tear gas, which is really painful and traumatic experience, and milk is a helpful cure for it. So it's this twisting of the story that, you know, rather than, oh, how dare the police occupy with their military equipment a community for a week solid, just about, but how dare people, you know, break a law and damage property to get what they need to treat the damage that's been done to them by this police force. Context is missing, as it frequently is. So, as I was saying earlier, this whole kerfuffle, I don't know what to call it on the radio, the backlash, the aftermath of the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson has revealed a lot. As other incidents like this, Trayvon Martin's shooting, have revealed a lot about racial dynamics in this country. And I thought this was a really good piece. And it's a man on the street perspective, which I think is how you take the temperature of a community. If you ask primarily government officials, police spokesmen, etc., you'll get sort of a whitewashed, PR-ified, ready for the public, cloaked, like kind of couched language version of what people on the street might tell you in more plain terms. So Julia Ioffe wrote this at the New Republic, and it's called What White St. Louis Thinks About Ferguson. This is from the 15th, so a few days old, still very relevant. So, and this is before, this is when it was quite calm, so you'll hear that in her introduction. She says, about a 15-minute drive from the Ferguson protest that by now feels more like a block party, in the more upscale St. Louis suburb of Olivet, there's a new strip mall with a barbecue joint and a Starbucks and an e-cigarette store. On a mild Thursday evening in August, people sat around tables sipping coffee, sipping beer, dabbing barbecue sauce off their fingers. All of these people were white. It was a stark contrast to Ferguson, which is 2/3 black. Olivet is almost the exact opposite, at over 60% white. St. Louis and the little hamlets that ring it is one of the most segregated cities in America, and it shows. Here in Olivet, the people I spoke to showed little sympathy for Michael Brown or the protesters. It's bull. Censored, said one woman, who declined to give her name. When I asked her to clarify what, specifically, was bull, she said, all of it. I don't even know what they're fighting for. It's just a lot of misplaced anger, said one teenage boy, echoing his parents. He wasn't sure where the anger should be, just that there should be no anger at all, and definitely no stealing. Our opinion, said the talkative one and a group of six women in their 60s sitting outside the Starbucks, is the media should just stay out of it because they're riling themselves up even more. The protesters like seeing themselves on TV, her friend added. It's just a small group of people making trouble, said another. The kid wasn't really innocent, chimed in a woman at the other end of the table. They all declined to give their names. He was struggling with the cop, and he's got a rap sheet already, so he's not that innocent. While the first point is in dispute, the second isn't. The police have said that Michael Brown had no criminal record. If anything, the people here were disdainful and mostly scared of the protesters and implicitly of black people in general. I don't think it's about justice for Michael Brown's family, said the teenage boy. It's just an excuse for people to do whatever they want to do. One man I talked to, a stay-at-home dad who is a landlord to three black tenants and one white one in Ferguson, my black tenants would never do that, he clarified, was more sympathetic to Brown and also had the sense that the police had overdone it a bit. But he was scared of the protests. I told him that the protest that day was entirely peaceful and festive almost. You know, he said, I have a wife and three children, and if something were to happen to me, that would be very bad. As for the protests, well, they weren't about justice. They were just an excuse. People are taking the opportunity to satisfy their desire for junk, said one woman knowingly, as if black people, the lust for theft encoded in their DNA, are just barely kept in line by authority. When they kill each other, we never hear about it, one of the Starbucks women said. This, she meant, was a good thing. When it's black-on-black violence, we never hear about it. Which it should be noted, that's a common, again, barely cloaked, pretty racially charged statement that we've been hearing a lot from white people, as represented by the mainstream media in general, by the dominant culture entirely. And it's interesting because if you look at Ferguson and look at the crime statistics, this is actually the first murder all year, and it was by a white police officer of a black teenager. There is little violence at all in this specific community, which is probably why you never hear about it, because it doesn't happen in that community. So, fun facts. And also, if we think about, there's a lot of violence, domestic violence, violence in general, that could be considered white-on-white violence, but you don't, when that happens, it's just violence. It's just disturbed people. It's just criminals. It doesn't get racialized in the same way that this idea of black on black violence, these people's ideas they're communicating in this suburb, that this is just an inherent thing and that people are just waiting for an excuse. You'd think that if people could organize so well in these communities and the goal really was just to steal stuff, it could have been done long ago. But maybe because those aren't the real goals of these communities. Continuing on. So this woman, again, when they kill each other, we never hear about it. One of the women outside the Starbucks. I asked why she thought that was. Because basically, they hate whites, her friend chimed in. Prejudice, reverse prejudice. Prejudice goes both ways. The others signaled their agreement. It's not Ferguson people. It's a lot of outside people coming in. This was a sore subject with several of the people I spoke to. A major problem with the protests, and they very clearly did not mean the militarized police response to the protests, was that they were tarnishing St. Louis's image as a nice place. I'm embarrassed to say I'm from St. Louis, the woman grumbled. Me too, said her friend. I don't tell people I'm from St. Louis anymore. This is not representative of St. Louis, said one of the older women, back at Starbucks. St. Louis is a good place, and Ferguson is a very good place. We've never had anything like this in St. Louis, her friend exclaimed, as if trying to clear the city's good name, ever. As the women grew uncomfortable, one of them hit on a way to fight back. Where are you from? She asked me. Washington, I said. Well, she said satisfied, you people have trouble too sometimes. And they all laughed. So again, that was White St. Louis Has Some Awful Things to Say About Ferguson by Julia Ioffe in New Republic. Obviously, this is anecdotal evidence, but like I said, I think that asking regular everyday people on the street how they feel about things is an effective way to take the pulse. And these are not freakish fringe statements by any means. These are versions of the same argument I've been hearing here in Spokane, here in the U.S. via my social media circles and everything. And through the mainstream media, there's a great, great, great article, which I will share some of, if not all of, by Mia McKenzie at Black Girl Dangerous, her blog, that's called Things to Stop Getting Distracted By When a Black Teenager is Killed, I think is the title. I'll find it. It's not open on my tabs here right now. But she points out that there's this real scramble to first clarify that this person's background somehow justified them being killed. There's a search for an incriminating photo of, gang signs or anything that's considered traditionally scary to middle America, white America, etc. There's the charges are always repeated, people saying, well, Michael Brown robbed that store, which is still not even confirmed. And there's immediate obvious problems with that. I don't know if people are familiar with how the justice system is supposed to work in the U.S., but robbery is not a capital offense. Armed robbery is not even a capital offense, though it's clear that he was not armed. And even if it were, the person charged would still have the opportunity for a trial, their day in court, all of those things that we hear. You have your rights read to you. All the things that we know and some love of how the U.S. justice system works all are skipped over in cases like this in favor of execution. So Judge Dredd style, these cops, this one cop, is judge, jury, executioner, and gets the benefit of the doubt every time. That's the problem with how policing's done. We've seen it in Spokane multiple times with our really, really tarnished record of police brutality here. And the benefit of the doubt from the state, from, you know, people consenting that, well, you know, police get to be their own. They get to police themselves. It doesn't work. It's clear that it doesn't work because we have so many instances like these. It deepens tensions between police and community when people take liberties like this, when they decide that, you know, using deadly force is justified so frequently with young black men. I have a friend who has a joke that that black men have laser vision and that's why cops and people are so afraid of them. And that really is the way it's handled, that you're automatically a deadly weapon yourself, even as an unarmed black man in the culture. And meanwhile, you know, people have been pointing out on the internet, in the blogosphere, that multiple white male mass shooters have not only not been shot by police, they've managed to be detained without any force being used on them at all. You can go into a public place, shoot 12 people, and somehow make it out alive. But if you're walking down the middle of the street with your hands over your head, you're considered too much of a threat to live. So that's the reality that we're dealing with here. And just kind of done with people trying to find any excuse they can to make this seem more justifiable. Well, you know, maybe he wasn't such a great kid after all. It's like, well, you know, I definitely made a lot of mistakes when I was a teenager, and no one was trying to justify executing me for it at the time, as frustrating as I might have been for parents or teachers. And also this idea that these women shared in St. Louis of reverse racism is just not a thing. There is no institutionalized oppression of white people in this country. There is not, in fact, a war on whites. All that there might be that might seem this way to certain people who, because of our white supremacist culture, are not aware of even the basics of how racism operates, as we move further a little bit toward justice for women, for people of color, for immigrants, for gay and lesbian people, for transgender people, it may seem to people who do not belong to those groups that they are losing rights to them. But what is overlooked is that, you know, there's a phrase, the rising tide lifts all boats, something like that. Other people having equal rights to you does not, in fact, infringe on any of your rights. What it might do is deny you of some of the unfair privilege that you've enjoyed over others for your life. That's not the baseline that people should be starting at. The baseline should be equality for all people. So I'm really sick of explaining this to white people in my life who may be well-meaning, but really need to step up and do some research. It isn't anyone's job to explain this to you. That's another frustrating thing. And, you know, it doesn't take long to do a little research into the history and see what people have really been dealing with before you start complaining about a war on whites. So please don't ever do that around me because I will freak out. Anyway, let me find what I was looking for. This is a good, this is an analysis of that written by Manic Pixie Dream Mama on her blog, manicpixiedreammama.com. And it's called A Mother's White Privilege. And a couple of my friends who are mothers shared this. And I want to contrast it with another piece that I have to track down. But I'll read this one first. So I'm hoping I can have enough time to cover everything I want to. But yeah, so this is her piece, Manic Pixie Dream Mama, A Mother's White Privilege. She says, wow, she has a really adorable picture of her kid that I'm distracted by. As the ongoing events in Ferguson, Missouri show us, America's racial tensions didn't disappear when George Wallace backed down from the schoolhouse door. Dr. King didn't wave a magic wand, and we never got together to feel all right. White America remembers this at ugly flashpoints. The Rodney King beatings, the O.J. Simpson trial, the Jena 6, Trayvon Martin's death. White America recoils in horror, not at the crimes, though the crimes are certainly horrible. It's not the teenagers gunned down, the police abuse, the corrupt trials. It's this. At these sudden, raw moments, in these riots and demonstrations and travesties of justice, white America is forced to gaze upon the emotional roil of oppression, the anger and fear and deep grief endemic to the Black American experience. Black America holds up a mirror for us, and white America is terrified to look. To admit white privilege is to admit a stake, however small, in ongoing injustice. It's to see a world different than your previous perception. Acknowledging that your own group enjoys social and economic benefits of systemic racism is frightening and uncomfortable. It leads to hard questions of conscience many of us aren't prepared to face. There is substantial anger at oneself, at the systems of oppression, and mostly at the bearer of bad news, a convenient target of displacement. But think on this. I have three sons, 2 years between each. They are various shades of blonde, various shades of pinkish white, and will probably end up dressing in polo shirts and button-downs most of the time. Their eyes are blue and green. Basically, I'm raising the physical embodiment of the man times three. The white is strong in these ones. Clerks do not follow my sons around the store, presuming they might steal something. Their normal kid stuff, tantrums, running, shouting, these are chalked up to being children, not to being non-white. People do not assume that with three children, I am scheming to cheat the welfare system. When I wrap them on my back, no one thinks I'm going native or that I must be from somewhere else. When my sons are teenagers, I will not worry about them leaving the house. I will worry that they'll crash the car or impregnate a girl or engage in the same stupidness endemic to teenagers everywhere. But I will not worry that the police will shoot them. If their car breaks down, I will not worry that people they ask for help will call the police, who will shoot them. I will not worry that people will mistake a toy pistol for a real one and gun them down in the local Walmart. In fact, if my sons so desire, they will be able to carry firearms openly, perhaps in Chipotle or Target. And I should add that each of those is a real example and has a link to the story that she's referencing. So when I post this link, you'll be able to see that and explore those stories a little more. They will walk together, all three, through our suburban neighborhood. People will think, look at those kids out for a walk. They will not think, look at those punks casing the joint. People will assume they are intelligent. No one will say they are well-spoken when they break out SAT words. Women will not cross the street when they see them, nor will they clutch their purses tighter. My sons will never be mistaken for stealing their own cars or entering their own houses. Again, both of those have links because they're real stories. No one will stop and frisk my boys because they look suspicious. My boys can grow their hair long and no one will assume it's a political statement. My boys will carry a burden of privilege with them always. They will be golden boys, inculcated by a lack of melanin and all its social trapping against the problems faced by Black America. For a mother, white privilege means your heart doesn't hit your throat when your kids walk out the door. It means you don't worry that the cops will shoot your sons. It carries another burden instead. White privilege means that if you don't school your sons about it, if you don't insist on its reality and call out oppression, your sons may become something terrifying. Your sons may become the shooters. Whew. So, I really like that piece for a lot of reasons that I hope are obvious. What she says at the end takes me all the way back to something I wanted to talk about at the beginning. Lawrence Ham, in that interview that Chris Hedges did, talks about how it's not about individuals, it's about institutions and structures. But a very important piece of that is that we can't change those institutions and structures unless we change the individuals within them, obviously starting with ourselves, but also hopefully rippling out to our communities so that, none of all the parents who are currently parenting don't hopefully don't raise kids who want to be cops at all. But or if they do want to help people, try to help people within an inherently flawed system. But that's another question for another day. But, you know, personal accountability is still really important. If we can't, we can't fix systems without fixing people. So, yeah, I really like that she brings that up. She's obviously parenting her kids in a way that's going to be really beneficial to everyone involved, at least in that sense. It just breaks my heart when I think about some of these people saying this painfully ignorant stuff online, thinking about how many of them are probably statistically likely to have children and what their children are learning from this. Because we're kind of hoping that these things like structural racism, like internalized individual racism, are just going to die in about 30 years. And that won't be so if people are parenting badly. I'm getting a call right now that I'm going to take. So bear with me while I push some buttons. Caller, you're on the air. Hello? Caller, can you hear me? You're on the air.
Hello?
Hi. Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hi. You're on the air. Are you intending to be on the air? Right, I'm going to drop that call because I don't know if that person realizes that they're on the air. If you did want to be on, call me back at 509-747-3807, and I will gladly project your thoughts out to the listening audience alongside mine. If anyone else wants to call in these last 10 minutes or so, studio line is open, 509-747-3807. If you're trying to call the office, person who just called, the number there is 747-3012. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the last few minutes of Praxis on KYRS, talking about the uprising in Ferguson, the militarized police force there, the unveiling of the racism that's under the surface here in the U.S. Here we go. Phone's ringing again, hopefully.
Hello?
Hello. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just listening to your show and enjoying it and thought I would like to make a couple comments, if that's all right.
Sure, go for it.
Well, I agree with a lot of what you said, other than maybe the idea of bringing children down there, because it seems to me like militarized police forces don't really respect that, and it'll just put them in harm's way. But I also think that... to put it in terms I understand, if you're trying to build a house and the foundation is not in good shape, you can't really build on top of that. And maybe the idea is right to tear that police department down and start over from scratch with a new type of thinking or something like that. But I'm not sure that having the systems in place that we do is the right way to try and rebuild on top of them.
Yeah.
Anyway, I really enjoy your program and think more people ought to be talking about it.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, what was your name?
Dale.
Dale, cool. Thanks for calling. Yeah, I think once we knew, I think once people saw what the police were bringing out into the street, they might be more hesitant about bringing their kids. I guess I just meant in general, like, I think getting your kids involved in social justice can be really
I think that's a great
awesome.
Idea.
Yeah.
I think that's a great idea, and I do that with my own children.
Cool. Well,
however,
thanks.
I think bringing them into an area where there are, you know, police officers with M16,
mm-hmm.
they can quite possibly be killed. Look at, they show no discrimination throughout the world
mm-hmm.
when they come to killing children. So,
yeah.
But I think that our duty as parents to educate them is very, very important. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for calling in.
Okay. Goodbye.
Have a good day. So, thank you, Dale, for calling. And again, if anybody else wants to call in, the number to call is 747-3807. I really like his metaphor about the house having a rotten foundation. And that's, you know, I think that's certainly true by any estimation in the U.S., you know, being built on violently stolen land with slave labor, and ongoing class-based oppression. Not a good way to start things off. So, but like he said, we can, you know, tear a lot of that out of the roots and start over. So, something I saw today that I enjoyed a lot. We haven't seen part of the big problem and part of the reason the media's been able to carry on in its hemming and hawing for so long about this case without making it just simply about justice, which it is that there's not a lot of great documentation of what happened between Michael Brown and this officer before his fatal shooting. We do know that from the autopsy that was released, the family requested an independent autopsy because the Justice Department and the Police Department were not being quick in doing that. The shots that were inflicted on him are consistent with a person with his back to the shooter and with their hands above their head based on the muscle evidence. And it's six shots were fired. So that's something that's out as of today. But a lot of these details hadn't been released. And there's no evidence that we can use to look at it. So, I mean, people are obviously familiar with cops, with, you know, these dramatic car chases that we see from the dashboard camera. And in Spokane, if you follow police accountability, you know that part of the police accountability measures that the voters overwhelmingly supported was to introduce body cameras to the Spokane Police Department. That's something that has been fought by the police department. The policy for their use has been watered down, to say the least. And today I saw this this graphic that summed it up. It says, Ferguson Police Department, riot gear, check. Tear gas, check. Camouflage, check. Assault rifles, check. Armored landmine vehicles, check. Dashboard cameras, none. So... That speaks volumes, I think, that as Lawrence Ham pointed out in that interview with Chris Hedges at the top of the hour, this militarization of police has gone on since the Nixon administration. It's ramped up since part of the whole deal with the military-industrial complex is that we have to keep making more weapons forever. There's only so many customers around the world, so the customers have largely become cities in the U.S., including Spokane. I'd like to go further in depth, probably next week, actually, about what the SPD arsenal includes. But it's dramatic. There are some of these. I've seen at least one armored vehicle, these large SWAT vehicles, AR-15s. There's a picture that I shared on the Facebook page for this show of the mayor shooting one of the AR-15s at the special expanded rifle range that the police department has here. These problems are very universal in this country. It isn't as though St. Louis County is the only county where the sheriff, the leadership of that county department, was sent to train in Israel. You know, the bastions of restraint in use of force, right? They have a lot of experience, to say the least, dealing with civil unrest during the decades-long military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. The IDF is notorious for their, I guess, their what you would call an effective military, effective in quelling uprisings through assassination, through arrest of children, through crowd control measures that look just like the ones in Ferguson. And there was a great story about Gazans and Palestinians in the West Bank tweeting tips about dealing with tear gas to people in Ferguson, telling them, you know, don't try to use water, use milk, or wash your hands, you know, giving this advice. And it's kind of a dark unity between the two communities, but pretty inspiring nonetheless. And there's people in Ferguson, you know, who are saying free Gaza, free Palestine at their protests. So these lines are being drawn between the two. And I'm getting another call, so I'm going to take it real quick. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Jeremy, and I want to talk about the industry of police.
Okay.
that's going on right now.
Sure, dive in.
So basically, right now, like in the SPD and in our jails, people are being put in jail and they're being held in jail for 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 months at a time, trying to fight for their innocence. And oftentimes the crime they commit, if convicted, they would face 1, maybe 2 weeks in jail. And there's no way for them to get out because financially they can't do it. And so they get stuck in jail. Well, this I was in California, and I got accosted by the police walking with a group of people and put in jail. Turns out I was the last person put in jail that night, and I was held for suspicion of being drunk in public. They wouldn't give me a blood test or a urine test or make me take any kind of breathalyzer. They said they could simply just hold me. And I was also held with, you know, my head being pushed down and forced to the ground and yelled at and screamed at and, you know, almost just beaten, with a friend of mine holding a video camera the whole time, telling the police officer that he was protecting me and the police officer telling him to get out of here. And, mm-hmm. you know, I just was pretty much blown away by what happened. I didn't see that sort of thing ever happen to me. And I think the industry of police is partially what's kind of going on right now, as mm-hmm. far as they have a definite control and need to use what they've been taught and need to fill up their jails and need to make themselves much more important than they actually are.
Yeah, I think especially now that we have privatized prisons in so many areas, it really becomes like you need to arrest this many people so that this prison can pay for itself. It's kind of a bizarre notion, but yeah.
Yeah, I think I read in our county right now, 83% of our costs goes to a Geiger County facility.
Mm-hmm.
And that's for the cost of the people that are incarcerated out there. And so if we're spending 83% of our budget on putting people in jail in a low security setting with maybe not obvious dangers, you know, maybe they have caused problems, maybe they haven't caused problems. A lot of them are drug related. I know that up to 90% of people in these jails are having some sort of an issue with drugs,
mm-hmm.
and it's more of an illness with these people.
Yeah,
and
a jail isn't a place to give people medical treatment.
No, it's a terrible place for medical treatment, and you put drug users together, and they find, you know, new people where they can kind of get what they need and get what they, you know,
mm-hmm.
figure out, put, you know, people that steal together, people that, you know, you create more crime. And part of that crime and part of the reason for that crime is if you're in there for 4 months trying to fight for something that maybe you didn't do, and you get frustrated with your situation and the fact that you aren't being let out and the fact that, you know, you are getting your due process, you know, you can finally, you know, after being beat down over a period of time, people throw their hands in the air and say, you know, screw it, you know, I'm going with, you know, with whatever. You mm-hmm. can only take so much.
Yeah.
Some people can only take so much, especially.
Yeah.
And this culture that's happening right now all over is it's all based off of the industry of the military and the weapon use and the police and,
yeah.
and everything that's there to try to, you know, make money off of our citizens.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for calling. I have to close things down because my hour is up. But thanks for calling in and thanks for listening.
You bet. Thank you.
So, again, if you're just joining us at the end of the hour here, you've been listening to Praxis. I did just want to share really quick. There's a lot of ties, as I said, between Black America and Palestine as far as police oppression. It's obviously not the exact same situation, but there's a growing solidarity between the two groups. And as you know, if you listen to the show, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions Movement, BDS, is a powerful force in ending the Israeli occupation. And successfully, thousands of protesters gathered in Oakland and blockaded a ship, an Israeli ship, from docking with its load. That ship is now kind of hovering around the California coast, and there are plans to continue to blockade it as it continues north up the coast seeking a port. There are actions planned in Tacoma and Seattle to prevent that from happening. So I'll post some links about that too in the podcast notes, which you can find later today at praxisradio509.podomatic.com, and also at facebook.com/praxisradio. Sorry, too much multitasking here for me. Thanks so much for listening. You've been listening to Praxis on KYRS, Medical Lake, Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.